Good morning, everyone. It is good to see all your faces here. We are continuing, we're chugging right along through the book of Matthew, our sermon series through this great first gospel. This morning we're going to be in chapter 8, verses 18 to 34. Thank you, Jonah. And as Tim Goff mentioned last week, we're at this point here in Matthew's gospel where Jesus is in the middle of this great big healing ministry. And where we pick up today, he's going to take a little detour away from that. And we're going to see a lot about who Jesus is and what it means to follow him. I was going to pray, but thank you, Mike, for that. So I'll just jump right in. So like I mentioned, where we pick up in this story, Jesus is in this little town called Capernaum, and this is in a Jewish region on the west side of the Sea of Galilee in Israel. And Jesus is healing all these people, and understandably, it's starting to draw masses and masses of people from around the region as word is getting around, and they want to see what's going on. So in this moment, Jesus decides it's time for a change of plans. So starting at verse 18, it says, "When Jesus saw the crowd around him, he gave orders to cross to the other side of the lake." So Jesus prepares to take this detour, and just by its nature, because there's only so much boat space, this is going to separate the true followers of Jesus from those who are there maybe just to see what all the excitement is about. And you kind of see this as these people start kind of coming out of the woodwork and speaking up to Jesus. First, we have this teacher of the law. Verse 19, it says, "Then a teacher of the law came to him and said, 'Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go.' Jesus replied, 'Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head.'" So this is a teacher of the law or a scribe. His job was to interpret the law, interpret these religious texts, and educate the people on it. And it looks like basically, he respected Jesus as another teacher. The problem was, Jesus was much more than a teacher, much more than a conveyor of knowledge. He was the Son of Man. And the life that Jesus was leading was nothing like the probably comfortable life that this scribe was used to in temples and synagogues, poring over religious texts. Jesus, in his ministry, was essentially homeless. He was a man on a mission. It's kind of wrapped up in this term, the Son of Man. But this mission was unlike any other, and he was calling disciples to join him in it. Now, verse 21, it says, "Another disciple said to him, 'Lord, first let me go and bury my father.'" So here we have a second person who speaks up, who's apparently been kind of tagging along with Jesus, and then he sees the disciples and Jesus getting ready to leave on this boat, so he feels compelled to follow Jesus more devotedly. But he has reservations. He says that he has some important family obligations he has to take care of. You see in this man's words this sort of internal conflict going on. He's torn as to what should be his highest priority, his highest calling. Well, Jesus doesn't leave any doubt as to the answer to that question. He says in verse 22, it says, "But Jesus told him, 'Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead.'" Interesting reply. This statement is intentionally shocking, and it's to make a point, which is that even as important as family is, there is a higher allegiance, and that is to one's maker. And certainly family is an extremely important obligation that's affirmed all throughout the Bible. Jesus himself, he affirms later in Matthew that the obligation to honor one's father and mother. But, you know, the best way to honor them or to love any family member is to love God even more, to love God the most. Now, so far in our passage, it's been this dialogue about who Jesus is and what it means to follow him. Now we move into this sort of living object lesson, this real practical demonstration about these things. So verse 23, it says, "Then he got into the boat and his disciples followed him." So he's now fully separated from the crowds, the spectators on land, and he puts out to sea with this core of committed followers. But right away, everything in their environment around them changes. Verse 24, it says, "Suddenly a furious storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat. But Jesus was sleeping." So they're in the middle of the lake, and abruptly the weather just turns on them with a vengeance. Matthew uses this Greek word seismos. It's like our word seismic. It literally means earthquake. We know from context it was not actually an earthquake, but Matthew's emphasizing the violence of nature around them. But even in this moment, as the wind and the waves are pounding this little boat, Jesus is taking a nap. He's out cold. You know, maybe for all we know, he wouldn't have woken up for a long time if the disciples hadn't woken him up, as we'll see in a minute. But a couple of points about this. Number one, it seems strongly apparent that Jesus was exhausted. Imagine being Jesus. Well, that's impossible to imagine, but it's a rhetorical device. Imagine being Jesus, the Son of Man, doing all of these miracles, having the power of God flow through you, but doing it in an ordinary human body, like you and I have. And, you know, I think about this, and I think about what makes me exhausted. I can't even play with my little kids for like an hour without needing to lay down. And unlike Jesus, I have a place to lay my head when I need rest. Jesus had just got through saying he does not have a place to lay his head. He has to try to catch a nap in between miracles. So, Jesus was exhausted. But a second point on this, Jesus sleeping in the middle of the storm is, I think, a picture of peace. A picture of peace. Maybe this sounds a little contradictory with him sleeping from exhaustion, but I think both can be true. In the Psalms, it talks about sleep. Psalm 4, verse 8, it says, "In peace I will lie down and sleep, for you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety." One of my favorite moments in my home is those mornings during the week, and this is not every morning, but some mornings during the week when I get up to go to work early in the morning, and I'm the only one awake, and everyone else is asleep. My wife is asleep, my kids are asleep, the dog is asleep, and in that moment, I have this sense that this is a peaceful home. Peaceful home. It's not like that all the time. It's usually not like that, but sometimes. But with that said, peace, deep inner peace, ultimately comes, of course, only from trust in God. And Jesus, we know, had complete and total trust in his heavenly Father. No matter the circumstances, no matter the chaos raging around him, no matter the storms. And I think this verse is an echo of that. Now, The disciples, however, were not a picture of peace. Verse 25, it says, "The disciples went and woke him, saying, 'Lord, save us, we're going to drown.'" Okay, these men, or at least some of these men, were experienced lifelong fishermen. I'm sure this is not the first time they've seen rough seas. I imagine, like Peter, you know, confident, brash Peter, probably thought he could handle anything. But this storm was just ferocious. And they cried out in desperation to Jesus. I wonder, have you ever prayed a prayer like this? Not necessarily about a storm, but a circumstance in life that makes you say, "Save me, Lord. I'm going to drown. That next wave that's coming, I'm not going to make it. You know, I thought I could handle anything, but not these waves. Not this wind. Not this, Lord. I can't handle this." Have you ever said that to God? I know I have. And so I see myself in these disciples, very, very much so. Well, the disciples' cries did not go unheeded. They were not just shouting into the void. Verses 26 and 27, it says, "He replied, 'You of little faith, why are you so afraid?' And then he got up and rebuked the winds and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, 'What kind of man is this? Even the winds and waves obey him.'" This is one of those times when Jesus just magnificently combines words with action. I want to talk about his words in a minute, but first his action. He's awoken from his sleep. I see his mercy and patience here. I know how I act when I am abruptly woken from sleep. It's not pretty. But Jesus responds to their plea. He is gracious, but he's also direct. He says what needs to be said to them. But then he demonstrates vividly why they don't need to be afraid. He stands up and he tells the storm to stop it. Stop it. And it stops. Nature obeys him. I want to share with you an illustration of this scene that I really appreciate. This is by a Christian artist from the UK. His name is Jeremy Thomas, and there's some great little details in this illustration that I appreciate. Notice how everything in this scene points to Jesus, literally. The raindrops, the break in the clouds, the waves, all of nature answers to him. And notice, too, if you can see, it's small, but the face and the body language of Jesus. He is all calm while chaos rages around him. The disciples, you know, their hands are in the air. They're crying out. We see his serene authority here. He is in control of everything. Everything within and everything without. Everything around him. Now, we looked at Jesus' action. I want to talk about his words and this exchange he has between him and these disciples. Jesus addresses them, "You of little faith." It's actually better translated something like deficient faith or defective faith. You see, the first thing the disciples said was, "Lord, save us." So that they call him Lord, and they apparently expect him to be able to do something about the storm. And yet, after he does do something about it, they are amazed. And they say, "What kind of man is this? Even the wind and waves obey him." It seems that they had faith in Jesus, but it was a confused faith, a sort of a fledgling, immature faith. They didn't completely understand or recognize who they had faith in, just who who this person was. But, you know, for anyone who claims to be a follower of Jesus, if he is who he says he is, our outlook on the inevitable storms of life is going to be radically different than it would be otherwise. We have the Lord of creation at our side, and we won't act as if we are alone at sea, castaways set to drift, flailing about. This past summer, Stephanie and the kids and I spent a week at Lakeside Bible Camp on Whidbey Island for one of their family camps, and the speaker that week was Micah Tuttle, who some of you know, and he used this great illustration for our walk with God that I want to share with you, so I'm going to shamelessly steal his illustration. But Micah has spent years as a missionary in South America, and on one occasion, as he tells it, they took this family getaway to this big water park down there. And at this water park, at one point, his daughter was at the top of this huge water slide, like giant water slide. She's sitting at the top of it. She's about to go down, but she gets scared, and she just froze. And Micah, her dad, is right behind her. He's trying to encourage her to go down, persuade her, coax her to go down, but she wouldn't. So finally, he clawed her hands off of the side of the slide and pushed her down. But he didn't leave her by herself. He went with her, with his arms around her. And what do you think she did? She grabbed onto him with this death grip, like her life depended on it, because she had nothing else to hang on to, and she trusted him. She trusted her dad. I think this is just a great illustration of what it means to walk with Jesus. He tells us not to be afraid, but it's not through some kind of vague worldly wisdom, you know, I don't know, meditation, having faith in faith, or through denial, or anything like that. No, we follow a person. And when the storm comes, when the adversity comes, as it must, any courage or hope that we are going to have has to start with this question: who is this person that we follow? Who is this person? The truth is, I follow the one whose voice all of nature obeys. The wind and the waves sure don't care about my voice, but they know his. And unlike everything around me and maybe everyone around me, he never wavers or leaves. And when it feels like there's nothing else to hang on to, as there probably isn't, he's not off at a distance telling me to, you know, have courage. He's right here with me in the boat or the slide. And I can cling to him when I can't cling to anything else. Now, this terrible storm that we've just read about, it may have led these disciples and maybe we the readers to forget that Jesus is actually on a mission here. He had a destination on the other side of the lake that he had in mind. And he had not forgotten. So, verses 28 and 29, it says, when he arrived at the other side in the region of the Gadarenes, this is a Gentile region on the other side of the lake, two demon-possessed men coming from the tombs met him. They were so violent that no one could pass that way. What do you want with us, Son of God? They shouted. Have you come here to torture us before the appointed time? Now, here is a rendering of this scene by that same Christian artist that I mentioned. This, I don't know if you can see it very well, but this is this only shows one man. Matthew mentions two. On one side of this, image, you have kind of this the dark hopelessness of the cave, and you can see the look of torment on this man's face. And I don't know if you can tell from far away, but behind him and all over the walls of the cave are these faces, these creepy faces representing the demons. And they're kind of taunting and jeering and leering at him, oppressing him. All of this is in contrast to the clear blue light of day that surrounds Jesus, who's kind of this figure of light and hope and deliverance. This is one artist's impression. In the text, the first thing I notice in reading these verses is how in command Jesus is. He's here, really, to do battle. And to reveal, once again, his absolute authority. So verse 28, it says, when he arrived, just forgets about the disciples. Matthew narrows this in on Jesus. And I picture him as he's nearing the shore. He kind of fixes his eyes up above the shore on these tombs. They were probably set in a cave. That was the practice. And the boat arrives, and he steps off into enemy territory. This place, this particular place, is a stronghold of the devil. And Jesus' footfall on that shore is a summons that's heard loud and clear in the spiritual realm. When the other gospel writers tell the story, Mark and Luke, they include some dialogue, and Jesus has this verbal command for the demons to come out of the men. But it appears that before Jesus had said anything, the men come out and they meet him. I don't imagine that these demons particularly wanted to come out and have a chat with Jesus. It's more likely that even before he set foot there, they were commanded to come out and appear before him. Just his presence is enough to drag these demons who have possessed these men out of the tomb, out of this realm of the dead in more ways than one, and face their reckoning with him. But unlike the disciples who had just wondered what kind of man is this, for the demons there's no question. There's no need to search and inquire and consider the evidence like we like to do. They testify immediately as to who he is. They say he's the Son of God, the all-powerful Son of God who's one day going to judge them. The demons know that one day they're going to be thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, Revelation tells us. But here and now, they seem to be surprised that Jesus is already invading their kingdom. Their strongholds are already beginning to be overthrown. They didn't expect this. And even if Jesus' kingdom isn't going to fully break through until that future day when he comes in power and glory, his actions here are a sign that it's already the beginning of the end for Satan's rule. Verses 30 and 31, it says, some distance from them, a large herd of pigs was feeding. The demons begged Jesus, if you drive us out, send us into the herd of pigs. Elsewhere in Matthew, Jesus is talking about demons, and he calls them impure spirits here. He says, when an impure spirit comes out of a person, it goes through arid places seeking rest and does not find it. So the demon's possession of a person is apparently in some way restful for the demons, even as it's torment for the person they're possessing. But they don't want to be without a home, and they want somewhere to go. So in our passage that we're reading today, these demons see these pigs, and they would prefer to stay in that physical vicinity if possible. And so they ask Jesus permission to enter the pigs. And he grants their request. Verse 32, he said to them, "Go." His only words in this whole passage in Matthew. So they came out and went into the pigs, and the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and died in the water. These poor pigs. At least for them, it ended quickly. For the demons, it's fitting that they are thrown into the sea. For the Jews, this was the symbol of chaos and evil and godlessness. So this foreshadows the demons' final judgment. But the main point is that this is a visible sign or a proof that Jesus is absolutely sovereign over the spiritual realm. We had just seen his sovereignty over the physical realm and nature. Now it's his sovereignty over the spiritual realm. Verses 33 and 34, our last verses here today, says, "Those tending the pigs ran off, went into the town, and reported all this, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men. Then the whole town went out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they pleaded with him to leave their region." So this understandably creates quite a stir in the community. And, you know, it's easy to read this and wonder, why did Jesus allow these demons to end up destroying this herd of pigs, 2,000 pigs, as Mark tells us, that would have been vital economic livelihood for these people? Why did Jesus allow this? First of all, Jesus is more interested in the souls of these two men and their eternal fate than in the money to be made from these pigs, or if they ate them, the sustenance from these pigs. And there's a second point here, which you see if you read carefully. What was the actual reason that these people rejected Jesus? It seems that what most bothered these people, actually, was more so than the loss of the pigs. It was simply that a miracle had happened. A crazy supernatural event that they couldn't explain, they didn't understand, and they had no control over. And it was right in their backyard. It was just too weird, and they didn't like it. Never mind that these two men, men they had probably known personally before they fell into demon possession, had been wondrously, joyously rescued from demonic bondage. No, these townspeople preferred their status quo. They preferred to stay in their nice, cozy, spiritual lethargy. It seems like they're saying something to the effect of, "Just go away, Jesus. Even, you know, we don't know what you have to offer. Even if it's good news, it's disruptive news. We don't understand it. We don't want to put in the effort to understand it. We just don't want that around here. So just leave us alone. We're fine here. Just go away, Jesus." Well, Jesus did go away. He left them in peace. But it was a false peace. They would still have to face him one day. We all will have to face him one day. These people were simply delaying their reckoning with him. And when we do face that reckoning one day, the question is, on which side of his authority will we be? One option is to ignore his authority, like the teacher of the law, who would only follow Jesus as a great teacher, but not as the homeless Son of Man. Or the disciple waffling on where to put Jesus on his list, his long list of priorities. Or the townspeople, who just didn't want to think about him at all. All of these found Jesus inconvenient. some of them may have thought that they could put off dealing with Jesus until another day. I'll think about that tomorrow. I'll think about next year. But, you know, we may keep thinking about that or delaying that until our time is up. And then you've wasted your life. And then, tragically, needlessly, you'll meet the same fate that these demons foresaw for themselves someday. But it doesn't have to be that way. There is another option. Jesus invites us to follow him. To do so means, first of all, to believe that he died on the cross for our sin, and he rose on the third day to defeat death and give us new life. But it doesn't end there at that one-time profession of faith. He calls us to live a life as his disciple in which we seek to know him more, to love him more, to become more like him every day. This is the only thing to do if we really truly believe that he is the Son of Man he claims to be. One Bible scholar, Gunther Bornkam, in his commentary on Matthew, he calls the story of Jesus calming the storm, but I kind of think this could apply to our whole passage today. He calls it a paradigm of the danger and glory of discipleship. The danger and glory of discipleship. I think danger and glory are a great way to describe life with Jesus. As we saw today, to be on the right side of his authority, it means oftentimes storms. It means discomfort. It means an overhaul to our priorities, an overhaul to our status quo. But it also means finding glory in unexpected places, like peace, like true inner rest. It means healing. It means deliverance. It means an end to fear. It means rescue. Let's believe that Jesus is who he says he is in all that that implies for us, and let's follow him today. Let's pray. Dear God, I want to thank you for Jesus. Thank you that he set aside the joys of heaven to come and walk a hard road in a human body on this earth in order to make a way for us to be reconciled to you. Thank you that he suffered and he bled and he died to pay for our sin. Thank you that we can walk with him in this life and be his disciple and learn from him. Help us to fully consider who it is that we follow and to cling to him in every circumstance. Be with us this week, Lord, and be with us in our worship now. In your good name, amen.